Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely, Scott Wilcox with Byard representing the appellant, Preservation Delaware, Incorporated. Your Honor, I'd like to take 10 minutes of the appellant's time to address the procedural error committed by Superior Court in determining that PDI was not an indispensable party. Mr. Bonkowski will take the remaining 15 minutes, and that will include my rebuttal time of 3 minutes. Mr. Bonkowski will take the remaining 15 minutes of time to address the procedural errors committed by the Superior Court in adding CCS to the case and to address the substantive issues. Your Honors, PDI respectfully submits the Superior Court in this case erred in denying the ZBA's motion to dismiss and determining that PDI was an indispensable party. As determined by this Court in Hackett versus the Board of Adjustment in the City of Rehoboth and Preston versus the Board of Adjustment in New Castle County, it is settled that the failure to name an indispensable party in an appeal of a decision of an administrative agency after the statute has run is a non-amendable defect. As noted further by this Court in Hackett, clearly a property owner whose interests are impacted by a ruling of a Board of Adjustment is an affected party, making it necessary to the appeal. That is because, as the Court of Chancery noted in the Council of Civic Organizations of Brandywine 100 versus New Castle County, the future use and development of the property hangs in the balance of the decision, and a potential significant diminution of the value of that property may be caused if the administrative decision is overturned. No other party in the appeal has a greater interest than the property, in this case, PDI.
So if your position prevails, that would be the end of the case, and we don't have to consider anything else. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. If the Court were to overturn the Superior Court's decision, then the matter would go back down to the Board of Adjustment, the Zoning Board of Adjustment, which upheld the or granted the variance, and so you would not have to decide the substantive issue. As the property owner in this case, PDI is a necessary party because it has because its ability to use and develop Gibraltar hangs in the balance of the decision of the appeal. If the ZBA's decision is overturned, PDI will be without a viable option for developing that property and without a revenue stream to maintain the remainder of that property. Moreover, the subject of the appeal surrounds the conservation easement, which the appellants claim that PDI was a party to. As a party to the conservation easement, PDI is necessary to determination of whether the easement is a self-created hardship. Since PDI is a necessary party, the next step the Superior Court should have taken to determine whether they could be added to this case would have been to look at the Rule 15, and specifically Rule 15 Relation Back Doctrine, to see if the complaint or the petition could have been amended to add PDI. Because there is specific 30-day statute of limitations found in 22 Del Code Section 328, the only way, that PDI could have been added to this case would have been under Rule 15C. And under Rule 15C, the appellants would have to show that PDI was on notice or should have been on notice of the appeal.
How does one become a party before the zoning board? Just show up?
In this particular case, Your Honor, PDI and CCS were parties to the case because they were the actual applicants for the variance. So the only real parties at the Zoning Board of Adjustment hearing were the applicants. PDI is the owner, and the equitable owner, CCS.
I thought CCS was the only listed applicable applicant before the ZBA.
They were not, Your Honor. There was some confusion in the Superior Court's decision. However, if you look at the appendix, you will find that the actual applicant, as required by the City of Wilmington Code, was the property owner, PDI, and they were noted as the property owner on the application, and CCS was noted as the applicant, if you will. In the decision, the ultimate decision, the only party named was CCS, but both parties by the City of Wilmington Code are required to submit the application and sign for that application.
And what's that citation? Do you have that citation?
To the, I don't have it at this point, but I'll be happy to provide it to Your Honor. Under Rule 15C, the appellants had to prove that PDI was on notice and that they made a mistake in naming the Zoning Board of Adjustment and not PDI. It's undisputed that PDI was not on notice. There is no evidence in this case that they were on notice of the appeal within the original 30 days, and the appellants don't make that argument. In addition, they don't there is no indication that there was a mistake by the appellees in not naming PDI. In fact, as the Superior Court noted and the appellees concede in their brief, they never intended to include PDI in the original petition.
And yet, the subject matter of the entire appeal would have been what happens to this property. So to the extent the appeal was going to decide what was going to happen to the property, your position is the property owner had to be joined in the appeal. Then if the property owner wanted to defer to the person who had a contract, that was the decision the property owner could make, but that certainly the appeal should not go on and determine the future use of the property without the property owner receiving notice and having a right to be heard.
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position, and I think that position is consistent with not only this court's holding in Hackett, where it said clearly a property owner whose interests are impacted by the Board of Adjustment is an affected party and therefore must be included, but is also consistent with a number of other decisions, including CCOBH case, the decision issued by Justice Jacobs, at that time Vice Chancellor Jacobs, in the Southern Newcastle County Alliance versus Newcastle County case, where it says that the property owner is a necessary party and must be included in the appeal, and then whether they choose to prosecute that appeal or rely on the equitable owner is a decision that they have to make, but they should be included. In this case, PDI wasn't given that opportunity, and because they weren't given that opportunity, it is our position that the case should be dismissed. Because PDI, the joinder of PDI, is not permitted under Rule 15, and they are a necessary party, the only way that the case could have survived would be for the Superior Court to decide in equity and good conscience that PDI was not an indispensable party under Rule 19B. Although it did not provide an analysis under Rule 19B, Superior Court did determine that PDI played no part in the variance application and its interests were well represented by CCS. PDI respectfully submits that this is both factually incorrect and against legal authority. Factually, as more fully set out in our brief, PDI did take part. They were on the application. They were extensively involved in the testimony, providing testimony at the ZBA. It was a testimony that was relied upon by the Zoning Board of Adjustment in coming to its decision that the application met the variance requirements. And so they were involved.
Was PDI separately represented at the ZBA proceeding?
No, they were not separately represented by counsel. They were there testifying on their own behalf, though. Legally, Delaware courts have consistently held that a property owner such as PDI has a substantially unique interest in an appeal that will suffer a unique hardship and prejudice in the event that an adverse judgment is rendered that not even the equitable owner of the property, CCS, maintains. Examples are
Did PDI take any active role in the Superior Court litigation?
Yes, it did, Your Honor.
In what way?
I represented them in that process, and I traded legal theories and thoughts with CCS. We did join in their briefing, but we were provided with a draft copy. We provided comments on that. We made arguments that were particular to PDI in that brief. In addition, we took part in all of the proceedings before the Superior Court and made all arguments on behalf of PDI.
So PDI either acted on its own or through independent counsel at the application level and then in the Superior Court level. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So there's never any suggestion that the attorney for the applicant who had the contract was representing both at any time?
There is nothing in the record that would suggest that.
What about as a factual matter, forgetting what's in the record?
Well, no, I don't believe that there is any indication that CCS represented PDI. They may have called PDI's representative as a witness because
were there any issues as to which CCS and PDI took different views
at which stage, Your Honor?
At any stage?
No, there were not. They were aligned. They have been aligned consistently on the need for the variance in this case, and that the application that was submitted was a good application for this property. So no, they've been aligned throughout this litigation. However, their interests are still different.
And as a practical matter, PDI did not present any motions or briefing or other argument other than joining in CCS's positions, right?
That is correct, Your Honor, did not. I see that my time is up. May I answer that question, explain that question, answer?
Sure, quickly.
Thank you. Your Honor, although it didn't present its own briefing for ease of judicial economy, we thought it was more prudent to provide one brief, but we did clearly express our own interests, express our own legal judgment in that case, by looking at the briefing that was submitted by CCS prior to it being submitted to the Superior Court. We did express our interests and our positions to the Superior Court in the conference calls and the hearings before the Superior Court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Michael Bonkowski from Cole Schatz for the appellant CCS, and with me is my friend and colleague Wendy Stabler from Saul Ewing. If I might quickly turn to Justice Ridgely's question, the application before the ZBA is at A316. We join, of course, in PDI's issue as to its indispensability and the fact that the Court did not properly see that as an essential part of the case below. Let me stress, though, briefly that the tension that exists between a buyer and a seller of a property is perhaps, at least to a real estate lawyer, self-evident, but especially in this economic market, the tensions become all the more dramatic, so that the identity of interest, to the extent there ever is one, dissipates with time, and I think it probably never even exists. And hence, I believe Justice Jacobs' opinion in Southern Alliance really comes to this issue. PDI is an indispensable party. It can never have a common interest with the applicant. The applicant can turn and walk at any time. It's a potential buyer. The stresses on the contract relationship speak for themselves. I don't want to belabor that, but I join in that argument.
Well, there can be obviously a divergence of interest at some point, but there may be a space in which the interests don't diverge at all. And isn't that exactly what happened here?
Well, I take your question, Your Honor, too.
It is undisputed, is it not, that PDI was content to have CCS take the lead role, including filing the briefs in the Superior Court, and basically the only role they played in the administrative proceeding before the ZBA was to have their people testify.
I agree with you, Ron.
I mean, if there were all this great fear about a divergence of interest, surely they would have participated through separate counsel actively, isn't that correct?
I don't disagree with that either, but if I may, Your Honor, respectfully, it seems to me that 15C3 has to be recognized as a two-part analysis. The first part is prejudice at sub A of number 3. The second part requires that the party that is indispensable and is being sought to, they are seeking to join post hoc, has to be brought within the 30 days. And so the Court's question going to whether or not PDI was prejudiced or had an identity of interest is only half of the investigation under Rule 15.
Well, as I understood your argument about this divergence of interest, and it seems to be that the property owner may have a preference to preserve the action taken by the Board of Adjustment or the Zoning Authority for future sales. And to the extent the buyer is out of time, out of money, the buyer would want to walk away. But so even though they may have a unity of interest for a period of time, the buyer just simply may lose interest while the property owner has a significant interest in keeping whatever they achieve through the action of the zoning authority.
I entirely agree, Your Honor. It has to be emphasized that PDI doesn't even get involved until the motion to dismiss is denied and it's brought back in. And I also wonder at the wisdom of having a post hoc requirement where we can reevaluate downstream whether the buyer and the seller have a divergence or should we deal with that proactively. I really believe when I read back to Sussex Medical and the cases that developed that ultimately led to Hackett, is that not what the Court in Sussex Medical was trying to do? They were trying to draw a brighter line and say you have parties that must be joined, and they must be joined within the confines of Rule 15 and Rule 19, and the Court in Hackett said we expressly ratify that. And I think the President Judge in Sussex Medical was trying to accomplish that. And so we come today, in large measure, we're in Hackett again. As Justice Jacobs asked appellee's counsel during the last argument, why was Hackett wrongfully decided? I don't think it was wrongfully decided. I don't think appellee suggested a good reason as to why. The realities are that Sussex Medical fills the gaps of 22.328, which this court recognized in the Schweitzer opinion at footnote 7. That's what you do when there are gaps. In fact, it was Your Honor who asked Mr. Gottes how is party defined in 328, and his answer was, I know it's not defined there.
Now, the official form, the appeal complied with that, right? The Superior Court official form?
It satisfied the form. Okay. I won't quarrel with that, Your Honor.
Is it fair to say is the form misleading then, and does that matter?
Well, we offer a case to the court that suggests that the form doesn't supersede the rules or the statutes. And I think, again, that's what Sussex Medical was intended to solve. You've got to pay attention to the parties. You've got to pay attention to Rule 15. This is a Superior Court certiorari matter. Our rules apply. I no disrespect to anybody intended in the litigation side of this thing out here, but I struggle with the notion that the rules misled. Petitioner and plaintiff is always in the singular.
Well, the question is, did the form mislead?
Well, I can only suggest that it should not have. Petitioner suggests that it did. And the court below accepted that it did, in point of fact. Again, a decision that I struggle with as a practical matter. But if this court intends to...
That form is still unamended, or is it still...
As far as I know, hasn't been changed.
Mr. Bonkowski, while I admit I'm sure everyone in the room is fascinated with the civil procedure argument that's taking place, will you have time to address the test for unnecessary hardship and the significance of the term self-created hardship for the purposes of obtaining a use variance?
Well, I respect and accept the court's guidance. I'll turn to that now.
Somebody may direct you back.
That's fine, Your Honor. I
don't want you to run out of time before you touch
as it. I did the last time. Searles versus Darling, and I'm pleased to be able to present properly titled this time, says quite directly that this court, chose not to adopt an absolute per se bar. That is the first issue. The Superior Court didn't even cite Searles versus Darling. It cited Baker, it cited a number of decisions, many of which did cite Searles versus Darling, so I struggle with the ability of the court below to reach this extrapolation that there is, in practical effect, a per se bar, an absolute per se bar. I don't think there is one. And but for that absolute bar, the application is upheld, the variance is upheld, allow me to stress. There's another reason why that does not apply here. If the court's willing to indulge the notion that there is such an absolute bar, contrary to Searles versus Darling, you then come to the notion that, as the court below pointed out in one of its footnotes, I think it's in footnote 40, that problems that are intrinsic to the property do not arise to the level of a hardship such as might invoke the hardship bar. And in this case, that is exactly what we have. This isn't about any of the various cases that are out there where someone has tried to build something in advance of an application, or someone has tried to manipulate the process. I think that was Jenny, by offering with one hand a section of property to be zoned in this particular way while gaining on the other hand. This is about a historic property, an historic property that, at least according to the record, no one had the ability or the wherewithal to salvage it. The state ceded that opportunity to PDI. And so when you have a property that is intrinsically, in and of itself, unique, the zoning over which prevents its salvation, not to be too dramatic, but that's what's happening. That's what a variance is for. That's why, even if there is such a per se rule, it should not apply to this. And lastly, on that topic, Your Honor, if I may, it's undisputed. CCS didn't create this problem. I mean, it's a redundancy to say that. The problem isn't with any party's actions. It's on the property.
I didn't read go ahead.
I was just saying, it sounds to me like, in response to the Chief Justice's question, you're defining the hardship differently from the way other people have. The hardship, at least according to the other side's argument, is that your client is basically hemmed in by the restrictions flowing from the conservation easement. Your argument is, no, that's not the hardship. The hardship are the intrinsic problems that have resulted from the aging and deterioration of the property.
Well, I apologize if I've led you in that direction. The hardship is the need to preserve an historic property in R1 zoning that otherwise doesn't allow commercial use. The easement allows commercial use, and it may be circumscribed to a measure, but it does allow that. But the zoning allows none. And while the easement certainly is an overlay, and it certainly has its own implications, the need here derives from the fact that the Sharp Mansion and Gardens need to be preserved, and the only way, based on PDI's testimony before the ZBA, to do that is with an adaptive reuse, to create a self-sustaining stream of income that will save this property without burdening the state and without seeing it fall into further decay.
Let me make sure I understand this. You've gone a long way to helping me understand it, but I still have one problem. As I understood the argument in the briefs, the conservation easement was accepted by the applicants in effect, or at least the property owner, if not the buyer. And it was argued, as I read it, that that made it a self-created hardship by accepting the conservation easement, which was an impediment to developing the property, just as the zoning is an impediment to developing the property. And in that respect, because it was accepted by contract, it was self-created. Why is that an erroneous concept under the law of Delaware?
If I may, I'm going to start from where you started and try and work back.
You may have to unravel what I said, because I just demonstrated that
the history is this. The Sharp family and the state of Delaware and PDI, Mr. Goddess calls it a tripartite relationship arrangement. Between Sharp and the state of Delaware, the conservation easement comes to exist. PDI takes the property thereafter. The argument is that PDI, by taking the property, I think initially the argument that was advanced was PDI actually created the conservation easement in and of itself as a matter of law. I don't think that's the case, but I think the argument then evolves into PDI, having accepted the property, drapes itself with the burden of having created the easement. And I think that fails for the reason I just alluded to, most importantly, which is, number one, this is not the type of hardship that normally flows into a self-imposed hardship analysis. This is a problem with the property. And that is a critical distinction when you line up every other case, including perhaps it was Jenny, which had it was described in a briefing as an overlay of a conservation easement. But in this case, this is all about saving an historic property in the face of zoning that doesn't otherwise allow that, given the history of efforts to do so. I see I'm summing up. So if I may briefly, I just want to note that there's been an argument advanced that the court below did not find there was a lack of substantial evidence to support the conclusion. That was joined below in the briefing. The court at footnote 63 specifically says, I find that there was substantial evidence to support the ruling but for the absolute bar. And that ruling was not appealed by the appellees, so I think they have waived that issue. But if it is not waived, it's a several-hour hearing. You can look at the list of witnesses. There were multiple experts. This is a case that was taken very seriously below, as you might imagine, just from the nature of interest in the neighborhood itself. And I think it's undisputed that there was substantial evidence. Unless the court has another question, I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, Jeff Goddess of Rosenthal Monheit for basically the neighbors, petitioners to the Superior Court. I'm going to step back just a moment. I'm sure there will be questions if the prior hearing was any indication, but I do wish to take a moment to try to set the stage on where it is we are and what is the tension. The people are rubbing up against each other and the principals are rubbing up against each other. There is a very narrow confluence of factors which gives rise to the arguments here today. If this were an ordinary appeal in what, for want of a better word, I would say an ordinary appellate court, there would be no issue. If this had been to this court, there would be no issue. The test would have been under Howard. The test would have been if there's a party that should be added to an appeal. The test would have been substantial prejudice. The words of Chief Justice Herman in Howard would have applied. An appeal should not be decided on technicalities. We want to get to the core of things. That would also be true in a federal appellate court. That would be true in most any appellate court. Now, the setting here is the Superior Court, but not just the Superior Court, on which I know three members of this esteemed bench have sat, but it's the Superior Court sitting as an appellate court. It's a hybrid situation. So we're already in a narrower universe than the whole notion of appeals and the whole notion of initial actions started up in Superior Court. We're in a situation where Superior Court is sitting as an appellate court and it gives guidance in its Rule 72. Its Rule 72 says nothing about going into the pleadings rules. Rule 3, which talks about what a pleading is, complaint, answer, the more typical language. I believe that's Rule 7. But what gets us back to these pleading rules? What even gets us back to Rule 15? What even gets us back to Rule 19? I am not sure. The jurisprudence in this state has moved in that direction. That is too big a stream for me to swim against. But at the same time, it is not gainsaid. It is certainly not obvious when one looks at the statutory law under which I took this appeal on behalf of hundreds of neighbors and the Rule 72 under which this appeal was filed that I did anything wrong. I'm not happy that I made the mistake that I made. You know, you get to a certain age in your practice and you start to wonder, are you getting rusty? Is something wrong here? This is a very unique situation. And since Sussex Medical, 8 of my colleagues have run into trouble in the same fashion. But it's a very, and I'm not saying a once in a lifetime, but it's a very small universe of cases we're talking about here. Furthermore, this gets toward a question that Justice Ridgely asked. This is unlike an appeal from a JP court or common pleas to the Superior Court, where there are prior pleadings, where there are documents that one can consult that makes it obvious who were the, quote, parties below and who are the parties above. This is not like an appeal from the Industrial Accident Board, where it's very obvious that in addition to the tribunal, you've got an employer and an employee. And there are pleadings framed up, and the representation of the parties is on record, and their attorneys is on record.
There's no caption before the zoning board?
Now, getting to that, Your Honor, there was a reference. It sounded wrong to me when my friend was referring to it, but unfortunately, Mr. Bonkowski dug it out. The zoning board paper at A316 says applicant CCS Investors LLC. That's on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, it says property owner Preservation Delaware, Inc. And then, bearing in mind that the neighbors don't receive a prior pleading, there's no prior discovery forth, as the record reflects. I tried to put Baker versus Connell when I spoke from the floor on a muggy summer night. I said, you're going forward. This is self-created. But, you know, the processes in a zoning board mimic to some degree or resemble to some degree. Heck, I was on a zoning board, so I don't want to be critical. But they have the trappings of an adversary proceeding, but they're really not. There's no cross-examination. There's no discovery. There's no pre-hearing conference. And in my transcript, at B3, I put in the transcript of the zoning board, as did our opponents. Here is what the chairman said to the assembled folks. The first case is case 1806, application of CCS Investors LLC, requesting permission to utilize the residence at 1301 Green Hill for office use and to construct a new office building.
Well, Mr. Gottes, you were telling us about how this is unique and esoteric, but the common denominator in these zoning cases is someone wants authority to do something with a piece of property, and you can either do it or you can't, and if you want to challenge the grant or the denial, ultimately, why wouldn't it be clear to everyone that if you're talking about what the property owner can or cannot do with the property, that they should be joined? Who has a greater interest in what can or cannot be done with the property than the property owner? For example, the property owner might even take the position, I don't want to do that anymore. But why shouldn't it be clear to everyone if you're changing the use of the property or denying a change in the use that the property owner should always be heard from?
Your Honor, I was never suggesting that the property owner should not be heard from. I was not trying to run a game on the property owner. But I was following what appeared to be the statute and the rules. Unlike that, the case that generated the Brandywine, I always get it, CCBOH, the Brandywine 100 case, that was an initial action. That was an original action where someone had 60 days after publication of a zoning change to bring suit. And it was said, and actually that case didn't say the owner, but it said the applicant should, you know, there the only person named or the only entity named was, what, the Newcastle County officials. There was no reason for someone, I mean, I don't want to, it's hard to answer this without personalizing it, but there was no reason to think that Ms. Stabler would not be in touch with PDI. There was no reason to think that PDI had a separate voice. One can read that transcript from the front to the back. They were among the many witnesses that Ms. Stabler orchestrated or put on the stand as she had this large notebook and said, now turn to tab 6 and what's your testimony? And then when further witnesses, Your Honor, when they were brought in to the case, I had a hard time serving them. Their registered agent was never around. If one goes to the docket sheet at A7, you see I got a non-est. I finally approached their lawyer. I said, will you just accept service so we can get on with this case? You know, and that's how it was done. And so far as Mr. Wilcox saying he participated, he was on a teleconference. One teleconference when we were talking about scheduling. Maybe I overlook it. Maybe there's been a second teleconference. But the reality was they didn't participate in the Superior Court even when they were on the record. So to get the neighbors to stumble us here, they front PDI. And then when they move over to talking about self-created hardship, we're not talking about PDI, then up pops CCS and says, our hands are clean. We had nothing to do with creating the problem. And it just does not seem right. And again, let me just finish this illustration as to how this is a narrow set of circumstances. Not only is it a zoning appeal, but if the applicant had been denied its application, and took an appeal to Superior Court, would it have been dismissible if the property owner was not in the caption of that appeal? Are those kind of cases dismissed? I venture to say they're not. And one can read reported decisions like that. The applicant says, I applied for a variance. I didn't get the variance. I want to go ahead. There would be a precedential decision out of Superior Court, or if it were carried further to this court, and no property owner in there. Now, the scenario, Your Honor.
Tell me the citation to any one of those cases. If you don't have it ready, you could send it in.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
So what you're telling us, there are cases where the application was denied, the court addressed the absence of the property owner on the merits, and the court held the property owner doesn't have to be in the appeal.
Oh, no, no, I'm not aware of any case like that. Oh. No, I didn't mean to say that. I just meant every day of the, well, it's not every day of the week I should have some cites in my hands. But there are instances where an applicant has filed an appeal to Superior Court and the case goes on and there's no motions to dismiss by the zoning board, no no indications that there's a grievance by a property owner. But to Your Honor, to address, if I do want to get back to the scenario because that Your Honor has brought up. If we are in the territory of Rule 19, this scenario where a developer loses heart and wants to abandon a case, I think Rule 19 would be easily satisfied. I can't imagine any member of the Superior Court bench when a developer who has appealed wants to abandon the appeal, that either the zoning board or the judge sitting on that case wouldn't say, is there anyone else who should be brought into this, who wants to carry this forward? What developer would have a contract, an option contract, to develop a property that gave it the unilateral right to dump out of a case, to step back from a case without a substitution by the property owner? I mean, I don't think that's a realistic – I mean, I appreciate Your Honor. I always have to answer yes when you ask, does anyone have more at stake than the property owner? Or, you know, agree with Your Honor that, of course, they do. But that's not the reality of what happened here and what happens every day.
Mr. Gottes, you seem to be making a bunch of points, but the dots haven't been connected, at least to my satisfaction. Could you summarize in a paragraph or less what your legal argument is with respect to the claim that you should have joined in the original cert papers? The owner and the applicant,
as well as the applicant. Well, so far as the applicant, there we can we're totally square with the language in Hackett and the process in Hackett. I'm talking about CCS now, because unlike the situation there, their lawyer did get notice. Their lawyer had indicated continuing representation. And those aspects of Hackett have been satisfied. But I'm making a broader argument, which encompasses both CCS and PDI, that Hackett and Sussex, upon which it relied, were erroneously decided. They, particularly Hackett, which refers to some special strictures of statutory certiorari proceedings, which are lacking. I mean, I don't see them anywhere, and no one has identified them. And when opposing counsel said, that the form doesn't supersede the rules in the statute, well, where are the rules, and where in the rules, and where in the statute does it say anything about mandatory per se? The property owner must be in a case, must be put on the petition within 30 days, or the appeal does not go forward. Well, it's just not said.
We're sitting on bonk, and as I understand, your argument is that Hackett should be overruled.
I think Hackett should be overruled insofar as it would be overruled. But I'm saying it could be overruled in a way that carved out certiorari and commended the Superior Court to adjust Rule 72 by making plain what is supposed to be in appeal papers, or adjusted its form, or commended to the legislature when it says this is what must be in a certiorari petition.
Well, and if Hackett is not overruled with the carve-out you suggested, is it distinguishable in a way that would support your position?
I believe that Judge Sleight's, well, I think it's distinguishable, readily distinguishable as to the circumstance with CCS, with the email that I sent in the contact. So far as PDI, I believe Judge Sleights was correct. I believe that when one gets into a Rule 19 analysis, they're not an indispensable party. So, well, I guess that is some modification of Hackett, but Hackett used the language property owner, but the reality is that it was the property owner was also the applicant in Hackett, and if Hackett could be circumscribed, or it could be meant that though we said it there, what is plain is that the applicant, someone has to speak for the, has to be included in the caption other than the zoning board, which is a pass-through party. So I get, what is the word be, modified, narrowed?
Let's assume we're writing on a clean slate. Are you saying there's no circumstance where a property owner is an indispensable party?
indispensable. If represented, if the position of that property owner, if there's another party in the case, well, I'm being inarticulate here, but if there's someone else in the case other than the pass-through board, other than the zoning board or the, you know, whatever building commission is there, they would not be indispensable.
With the applicant, a prospective buyer and the zoning board, there's no scenario involving those entities or people where the property owner is an indispensable party.
I guess I yield to that, yes. I do. I think they're a party who should be heard. And if they wanted, if they didn't like the way something was going, they could, you know, they would get it. They'd be readily allowed in under Rule 19 and
they could intervene, in other words.
Right. They would readily be able to come in. You know, but yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. That, I mean, or that, I guess that's the logical conclusion of what it is I've been arguing. That if they had been the applicant and I had just put in the zoning board as in the caption, the only argument I would advance, would be able to advance, is that nonetheless I satisfied the statute. But here I put in the applicant, or made clear that I wanted to include the applicant, name the applicant on the precipice.
I don't want to shortcut anyone else's questions on this issue, but before your time runs out, Mr. Gattis, could you address the test for unnecessary hardship and what constitutes a self-created hardship on the facts of this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think perhaps it was Your Honor, perhaps another member of the panel, who caught that the hardship here is not any configuration of the land or anything typical about the land. In fact, this land could be developed for some fairly high-end homes. You know, 6 acres of land in the Highlands community in Wilmington could certainly have been developed, and indeed, before this conservation, the record reflects that. The record at the zoning board, before the conservation easement was put on, there was a developer who was going to do that, and so there was a thought, well, we've got to do something. We've got to save this building. The building was going to be taken down, and you know, large, you know, homes were going to be put up there, you know, behind the gated walls with a nice garden, you know, as several other developers had done in the city over by Highland School and elsewhere. So this was put in. It was put in by contract, and the only authority I'm hearing from the other side is that, well, you know, you can read Searles real large to say there's not a per se disqualification, but I think Searles is quite distinguishable. Searles is purchased with an awareness, and this court said just because you purchase with an awareness, you're not disqualified. But that is not created. That is not a self-created hardship. It's one thing to purchase with an awareness and apply to a city council perhaps for a full rezoning. I mean, that avenue remains open here. It always remains open.
Well, let me stop you right there, because this may not be relevant to the legal decision that has to be made here. But as of right now, if the use variance weren't granted, what could this property be? Tell me what can be done with this property.
Well, in today's economy, it is, you know, as everyone's aware that, or has heard, I don't know how aware we are, that nonprofits are struggling. It's unquestioned. But PDI has had this property now for 12 years. It could have been a bed and breakfast. It could be turned into condo housing with a common garden. I'm not a developer, but all those things could be done. And more importantly, I guess, or more to the, well, I think of equal significance, let's just say, not more, is the fact that they could seek a rezoning. I want to, again, take a moment and carry folks back to what happened here. There was an application, I believe it was in May, There was a hearing set on a summer night in July or August, 200 people in an auditorium, and that is not the process that is followed on a rezoning, which continues to remain open, which Judge former Justice Quillen noted of significance in that case involving the I believe it was the car wash application. They could go to City Council. If there weren't petitions, the city code says that if there's opposition by 15% of the people living within 100 yards, if there's opposition to the rezoning must pass City Council by a three-quarters vote. Otherwise, it's a majority vote. But there's a process, and it would be referred to the Planning Commission. It wouldn't be run-and-gun hearing from the hip of a summer eve. There would be studies. There would be design drawings. There would be planning. Should we put restrictions about, you know, how open should this zoning be? Should it be all the way to commercial that you can build a two-story office building with more parking in front of it than there is in Trolley Square? Should you do that in a residential neighborhood? Or maybe it could be configured this way and that way. The rezoning process remains open to these folks, and they know it. So, literally, I don't know what could be done, but something other than R1, they could take the building down. You know, we're all learning to live within limits, and maybe this building is not salvageable. Or perhaps they could do what they do in England and build flats in the building. There are alternatives. I don't mean to be presumptuous. I haven't studied those numbers, but their own testimony was that without the building there, their economic expert said, you know, there would be enough lots to build, you know, sell the lots for several hundred thousand dollars and put up $600,000-$700,000 homes, and you've got your money back in spades off of something like that. But lastly, I want to talk about on this self-created, the best cases they have are all area variances to make something fit, to make something extend. This is a use variance. This court has always recognized the keen appreciation that use variances are most disruptive to other people in a neighborhood. So you've got not just a self-aware, but a self-created hardship, creating a use variance, or an application for a use variance. And with respect, I don't think Searles carries them that far, and I think the court below was quite correct. Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be very brief. A couple of preliminary points with Hackett. Mr. Goss, my friend, suggests that Hackett is easily distinguishable. I don't see it being distinguishable at all. There are a couple of things, though, in that context I want to emphasize. In the 30-day window of time from the issuance of the ZBA decision to the issuance of the appeal, there was nothing done by Mr. Goddess that differs from what happened in Hackett to suggest to CCS or its attorney that there was an appeal coming and they were going to be named in it. He sent an email, which in and of itself is nondescript, and I suspect this court is chary to jump into the notion that a courtesy copy can stop a party to an appeal or any litigation, and that's what's suggested. Pardon me. Ms. Stabler does send a letter to this, I think it was Mr. DePinto, I cannot recall. But I'm not sure that that extends the analysis in any fashion. If this court is to step in and to parse out the quantum of intent to be derived from an email here versus being served on the certificate of service, as I understand happened in Hackett, the attorney for the landowner, Sands, was served with the original appeal, I see no difference whatsoever. This is Hackett. Hackett makes evident good sense when you consider it in light of what was trying to be accomplished in Sussex Medical. And I hearken back to that. There's a lot of bemoaning that the rule was ambiguous and the forms misled. Well, the forms didn't mislead as to plaintiff. He has four petitioners, not one. So there are lots of commonsensical things that one can pause on, and I think that's critical. And I'll end just with this thought. And nothing in the record suggests that Mr.
I have a question for you when you're done.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Wouldn't it have been easy to pick up the phone and say, Ms. Stabler, will you accept service? Isn't that what every litigator does? The parties are identified on the application. He knew who was at the hearing. Isn't that the end of the issue? And nothing suggests that that was done. What we hear is 15 days post hoc, a precipice goes out. And for the life of me, I struggle with why Judge Sleitz uses that to pull back inside the 30 days to establish the intent that's required under sub B of 15C3.
Why should not Hackett be overruled?
I think Hackett represents a studied logical reaction to a history of cases like this, where people are fussing over who was in on time, why didn't you join me? The court abhors a vacuum, and in the context of all of those precedents, and Judge Sleitz bemoans them himself in his opinion, he talks about how many decisions they are and how difficult they are to get his hands around. The fact of the matter is, Judge Cooch dealt with that. Hackett ratifies it as solid logic, and that's why it should stand. There has to be at some point where it's clear. And again, I come back to 15C3 has two parts. It's not just prejudice. Prejudice derives from the notice and the content of notice. That's sub A. But B, it says, and must have known or should have known within the 30 days. So the rule itself contemplates that this is not an open-ended exercise, that at some point we're going to have to draw a line. It's reasonable. It's good for the courts. It's good for the litigants.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.